Accession number 17370, Gaspar Araanyan, reel 1.
Gaspar Araanyan, yes. Reel 1. So if I could ask you first of all, Gaspar, to tell me something about your background, where your family originated from.
Well, my father's family have lived in Palestine, in Jerusalem, actually, for several centuries. I don't know exactly when my first ancestor went there, but the family had been there for several centuries, and one of the oldest Armenian families of Jerusalem. My mother came from Çanakkale in Turkey, on the Dardanelles. She, together with her parents, went to Jerusalem on a pilgrimage. That's where my father met her. And they got engaged and they were married. And we lived there. And I was born in Jerusalem in Jerusalem, 1911. Actually, it was Palm Sunday, and the family was getting ready to go to church when I decided to come. So that's how it is. And I grew up in Jerusalem. I went to the Armenian school first. My very first memory of a war must have been in the late summer or early autumn of 1914. My grandfather, my mother's father, had come from Turkey to visit the family. I don't remember anything about his coming or his visit to us, but what I do remember very clearly was the day he decided to leave. Because it was said that war had broken out and he wanted to go back to the family. And I remember very distinctly he was standing there in the yard of our house and saying goodbye, and next to him was a porter, because in the old city there was no car could come, so they had to get a porter to take him to the station with his luggage. And that's the very first memory. Then I don't remember anything except the fact that there was some sort of difficulty in many ways in the country. And I have some recollection of seeing Turkish soldiers, very shabbily dressed, coming round to the houses begging. And then there was shortage of food. And I remember rationing, and almost the only thing we could get was bread, which was very, very poor quality. And almost all the colors of the rainbow were inside that bread. God knows what they had in the bread. And but it was something to eat. Shortly after Turkey entered the war, which was in November 1914, my father was conscripted, and he was sent away. He went. We didn't know where he had gone. He must have gone to Turkey to join the Turkish army. And my mother had to care for us. And she didn't have much money. She was a seamstress. She did some work. She made dresses and tried to keep us alive. And one thing I do remember, one of the things we used to eat was sesame seed cakes. what remains after taking out the sesame oil from the seeds. And usually that was something fed to the animals. But we used to buy that because very cheap. And I remember eating that with appetite. So then my next recollection was, it must have been in December 1917, the British had entered Palestine and they were trying to capture Jerusalem from the Turks. I remember very clearly hearing the whistling sound and then terrible explosions with artillery. And then I was about 6 years old, and my daughters were a few years older than me. My sisters, I mean, were a few years older than me. But we were all scared, we were frightened. And my mother decided to take us to our neighbors. We had very good neighbors, also Armenian. And the father of the house and the mother were there. And they had a young son who was in his teens at that time. And we knew that there was an older son who would have been conscripted too, but he was hiding somewhere. Nobody knew where he was, sort of, so that he wouldn't be taken away. So my mother decided to take us for the night to these neighbors. So we went there. They put some mattresses on the floor. We slept on the floor. And bombardment was continuing until the early hours of the morning when it was silent. Everything was silent, no more explosions. So the father of the house got up and said, "I want to go and see what has happened." So I remember he went out for about an hour or so. Then he came back. He said, get up, all of you, the English are here. They captured Jerusalem. So as soon as he said that, the elder son all of a sudden came out of hiding. We hadn't seen him for a long time, so he came out. Then the British were there, and the next thing I remember was, I think it was in 1919, when we had the first Arab-Jewish troubles. What I remember was it was Easter Day, and my mother had taken us to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. We attended the service, and usually there's a procession around the tomb and so on. When it was all over, we walked back home. On the way, we saw blood in the streets, and we realized that there was some trouble. Apparently, that was the first time that the Arabs of Jerusalem had heard about the Balfour Declaration. So they started attacking Jews. So we rushed to back home. And then we heard that the curfew was imposed on the old city. And we saw Indian soldiers patrolling the streets of the town. So we stayed indoors. Then another thing I remember was that in the Armenian quarter, opposite our house, was the one of the walls of the Armenian monastery, St. James Monastery. There were some windows there, and I remember hearing that somebody was looking through one of these windows while the curfew was on, and an Indian soldier shot and killed him. Yes. So this is another thing I remember. And then, gradually things started going to normal. It was quiet and curfew was lifted. It went on for a while, and then there were more troubles in 1921. They started in Jaffa and then spread to Jerusalem. More troubles, more curfews. And
that was between Jews and Arabs again, was it?
That's right, yes. Incidentally, our neighbor's son, who was in hiding, was among the first to become a policeman under the British. Yes. And
how did the Armenian community fit in between the Jews and the Arabs?
Their position was difficult. They had lived with the Arabs very happily. I mean, they considered themselves to be almost, especially the older residents, Armenian residents of Jerusalem. Although they were Armenians and they professed their loyalty to the Armenians and so on, but at the same time they considered themselves to be something like Arabs. You know, they belonged to the same people who were the indigenous population of the country. So they went on very well with the Arab population. And when, of course, things became more difficult between the Jews and Arabs, their position became a little difficult because they were friendly. And the Jews who were there before this political Zionism came about, we lived very amicably with all the other communities, you know. I remember my father had a barber shop, and he, in one corner of his shop, there was a watchmaker, a Jewish watchmaker, and he's working there with him. And some many years later, when I grew up, I was a young man. Of course, things had changed completely, but I was walking in the street where that Jewish watchmaker saw me, recognized me. He came and hugged me. Yes, like as if I was his long-lost son. And so, I mean, there was no trouble. It was only when the political Zionism was introduced that the troubles broke out.
When did that become sort of quite obvious and strong, would you say, of Zionism, looking at it from the Palestinian perspective?
Well, it was as soon as they heard about the promise given to the Jews and in the Balfour Declaration. Especially because they, the Arabs were disappointed because they had heard about the promise that was given by the British authorities to Sharif of Mecca, Sharif Hussein of Mecca, yes, 1916, McMahon, yes,
yes.
The High Commissioner in Egypt. So they knew that there was going to be some sort of an Arab government. According to the promises, there was going to be an Arab country stretching from the Mediterranean to the Persian Gulf. It was all going to be under Sharif Hussein, who became King Hussein. But that was, of course, forgotten. And then we had Sykes-Picot agreement, which again changed the position, with France came into the picture, and when King Faisal went to Damascus, he was thrown out by the French, and then they tried to bribe the Hashemite family by giving the Transjordan to Abdullah. Of course, the whole atmosphere changed. There was great joy when Britain came and captured Palestine. Everybody was happy, but then gradually the atmosphere changed completely. So after the 21 Troubles, of course, there was a little calm for a while, especially when, between 1921 and 1929, there was relative calm in the country. There wasn't much trouble. Then 1929, there was more trouble. It broke out on a Friday, I remember. It was a Friday in August. And the Mufti of Jerusalem, Hajj Amin, delivered a sermon in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and attacking the Balfour Declaration, the British government for having promised a home for the Jews in Palestine, and the policy of the government in general, sale of lands and so on, and facilitating the sale of lands to Jews. So that was a sort of incitement. And after the Friday prayers, the people went out, the Arabs went out and started attacking Jews right and left. And that was when a number of Jews were killed in Hebron. That is where they were living there for centuries without any trouble, but that after that attack. And the thing is, because the situation was calm in Palestine at that time, there were no British soldiers. There was just one, I think it was just one small unit of RAF. So it was the police that tried to keep order, until some more soldiers were brought from Egypt. It went on for a few months, and then it was quiet again.
Then did this sort of affect your life,
Gaspar? It did, of course it did, because you didn't know what to do. I always wore a hat, for example. And then gradually it became clear that there was some sort of tendency to identify anybody wearing a hat as a Jew. Then the next troubles were 1933, but these were purely against the government for against the British government. It was they attacked the government offices, things like that.
What were you doing at that time in 1933?
I was working. I was working in the law courts. I started working on the 1st of November, 1928. I had to leave school early for family reasons, and I started working in the law courts in November 1928. So I was still working in the law courts in Jerusalem in 1933. And, I continued until the end of the mandate in Palestine.
That must have given you quite a good insight, being in the sort of law courts,
yes,
as to you know, what troubles were going on, did it?
Yes, well, we had a number of cases we connected with the troubles. And we used to give, we had, that was in 1936 when we had the war troubles. Incidentally, there's one incident that would be interesting. I had a cousin who was a senior officer in the police force. He was one of the early appointees to the police force, and he did very well, and he was promoted very quickly, and his position was assistant superintendent of police, which was one of the highest positions held by non-British officers. Anyhow, he was in charge of criminal investigation, and he told me this story. It was in 1938, during the troubles to which I'll come back later, that he received a message from the central prison in Acre in the north of Palestine, that somebody who had been sentenced to death for having killed Jews was about to be executed, and they asked him if he had any special wish before he's hanged. He said, yes, I'd like to see Ibrahim Bitar, that was the name of my cousin. So they telephoned him, and he said, yes, I'll come and see him. So he went and saw him in prison. He told him, look here, you were in charge of this case in which I was sentenced to death, and you were also in charge of another case in 1929 when I was acquitted. Now, I am not guilty in the second case, 1936 case, but I was guilty in 1929. So I am going to die not for this crime, but for the other one, for the 1929 crime. Yes. And he told me this story, which is quite interesting. Now, in 1933, well, there was quiet again, or relative quiet in the country. There was always skirmishes and things, but in general, it was quiet. Until 1936, I remember it was in April when a friend of ours offered us to go with him. He said he was going to Jaffa for the day. Why don't you come with me? It was good to see, to be by the sea for a change. And so we drove to Jaffa. Just before we reached Jaffa, at the village, Beit Dajan village, police had the checkpoint. They stopped us. They said, there is trouble in Jaffa. We suggest that you don't go. So we had to go back. Apparently, there was an Arab was attacked by Jews, and the Arabs retaliated. So there was a lot of trouble, and these troubles spread to the rest of the country, and they continued for 3 years until the Second World War, when it stops. So during that time, we had very frequent curfews. There were all kinds of incidents, bombs, explosions, and the shootings. And in general, of course, life was no more normal. But we continued working as far as we could.
Related at all, you know, the rise of the troubles from this period to 39, 36 to 39, with the issue of, you know, more Jews coming in.
Oh, yes, yes. That was, well, immigration was continuing all the time. You know. There, every now and then, the official gazette of the government published orders allowing so many thousands of more Jews to enter the country. And this was the cause. Every time there was something new, and or somebody saw a boat bringing more Jews to the country, and it erupted again. This was all. And then, well, there were some incidents connected with the sale of land. Vast areas of land, especially the area between Haifa and Jaffa, were sold by absentee landlords. That part was sold by a Lebanese family. That was the Sursok family. They were not getting much from the land, but there were villages, and the villagers were sort of cultivating the lands, but the owners were not getting much. So when they had an offer from the Jews to sell the land, they sold the land. And that was another cause for trouble, because when the Jews came round and told the villagers to get out, this is our land now, well, what do you expect? These people have been living there for centuries. All of a sudden, they became landless, and so there was trouble there again. It was repeated in other places also, other than the source of land. So in 1936, this thing went on, and I was working in the courts, and then it was in 1938, actually, it was the end of 1937 that I was appointed to be the notary public of Haifa. And with effect from the 1st of January 1938, so I was transferred to Haifa.
Is that position like a judge? Would it be a...
No, that's a position of... Well, here you have the solicitors do the work here with the notary public and commissioners for oath, you know, they call them, I think. So that my duties consisted of authenticating documents. Any document somebody wanted to sign a power of attorney, he could come and sign it in my presence. I would authenticate it. But... there was one kind of document which under the old Ottoman law, which was still in force in Palestine, which was very important, and because it involved sale of land. It was called, the English name given to it was irrevocable power of attorney. You see, the idea was that somebody wants to sell property to somebody else, and he signs a power of attorney. That kind of power of attorney cannot be revoked. Once he has signed it, and he appoints by that power of attorney somebody to transfer the property to the purchaser's name. And there were several cases of Arabs selling land to Jews by such a document, such a power of attorney. The leaders of the revolt in Palestine at that time, the Arab leaders, we were told, we heard the rumor, that they were planning to attack the office of the notary public to get information about any Arabs who have sold land to the Jews by virtue of such power of attorney. So I was given a pistol, a licensed pistol.